Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
Alisa Jaffe in for Ken Schramm at 6 minutes after two. If you look in your medicine cabinet, has the expiration date passed on your meds? If you look at a jar of aspirin, would you take it if it said, you know, that was supposed to be best by June of 2010? Well, what will it do to you if you take expired medicines? Well, there is one city in Oregon that is being forced to use expired medicines when it treats its patients. And the paramedics in the Bend Fire Department say they have expired medications, but they have to keep using them because of a certain problem there. Tom Wright is the coordinator, the emergency medical coordinator, medical services coordinator for the Bend Fire Department, and he joins us now. Hi, Tom. Thanks. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking time out to talk to us today about this. How bad is the problem? I mean, how many medicines do you have that have already expired?
Well, fortunately, the big crisis has passed us around January and February. At that point in time, we had probably out of about 40 total drugs that we would give on a normal basis, we had 11 that were totally expired. And it actually just wasn't us in Bend. It's actually across the entire nation. We just happened to be the one that finally got tired of waiting for government action, and we finally got our attorneys involved and our physician advisors, and we established a policy, and it kind of went viral. We kind of put it out there, and a lot of other cities picked it up because we were all struggling with the same thing. We were getting no direction from the people who regulate us.
So you are saying this is a problem, these expired medications that are in the fire departments that first responders are having to use all across the country, probably even here in Washington. A lot of agencies have expired drugs in their kits.
It will depend on agency by agency. Obviously, the larger the agency, you usually have then a little better distributor who has a little larger supply. But I would be very surprised if you didn't find some expired drugs somewhere in almost every fire agency across the nation.
Okay, well, why? Why don't you just go get new meds?
Well, we would love to. It's one of those interesting situations that the manufacturers do not have to give any notice that they are going to quit making a drug. And so just all of a sudden, you find out when you place an order that not only does your distributor not have it anymore, but the manufacturer doesn't have it and may not choose to make it for another year or so. And so that puts you into a crisis mode where, okay, we go out and try to find an alternate drug, but the situation is that then that alternate drug becomes in short supply because all of a sudden everyone's trying to get that particular drug. So what we have found out is that the FDA at this point in time has no regulation on when a company can decide just to, they're going to buy out a company and shut down the line, or they're going to decide to make a more profitable drug. Most of the drugs we became short supply on are all having to do with they're usually generic drugs and they're usually low profit drugs.
But what about things that if you're stopping and you've got a first responder who's watching somebody who has a heart attack and they've got to give them something, or maybe somebody who is having an allergic reaction, and you've got only a drug that's expired, don't you worry about your liability?
We actually did, and that's why we actually worked. We had a very good team here. Our risk manager and our city attorneys got together with our insurance carrier, and we said basically we would rather give an expired drug than no drug at all. And this is based on the fact that we do know that, for example, when doctors or paramedics go overseas to work in some of these third world countries, they use expired drugs and they haven't seen any adverse reaction. And the military has used expired drugs for some time.
But there's a mix on that, Tom, from everything I'm reading. Yes, some say you can do a drug to treat influenza for, you know, 5 years past the expiration date. But when I'm hearing some medical experts say tetracycline type antibiotics that and some seizure medicines can actually cause real serious toxicity if it's taken beyond the expiration date, and that could be fatal.
Well, yes, unfortunately, we don't give tetracycline. That's the one drug that has been identified as being able to cause some problems. The drugs that we are giving actually have been used in other environments for at least a year past expiration. And what we've decided is our two physician advisors said we could use the drug up to a year past expiration. And finally, the Oregon Health Authority finally came out and gave us permission to do that as well, too. That was one of our frustrations is we've been asking since June of 2010 for them to make a policy.
Oh.
And they finally came out and made a policy that's going to allow us to use it for up to a year afterwards.
I talked to a guy at another small fire department near you, and he said to me that they have expired medicines. And what they do is they take their expired medicines and they swap them out with the ambulance drivers from maybe the bigger cities, because those guys might have the medicines that aren't expired, and they'll be more likely to get more medicine later. But that just doesn't sound like something the doctor would say is an okay thing to do.
Well, it's interesting on that point, and this is the frustration that all EMS agencies have had, is we have gone to our government agencies, such as the Oregon Health Authority, the Board of Medical Examiners, and the Board of Pharmacy. For example, we actually checked in with the Board of Pharmacy for the state of Oregon to see if we could do that, and they said absolutely not, that is totally illegal, because we are not distributors. We are recipients of drugs, and we're not allowed to exchange.
But it's happening, isn't it, Tom?
But it's happening, and it's just like the Oregon Health Authority said we couldn't carry expired drugs, but we had to look at the fact of what's going to be best for the patient. And, for example, we will give a patient a choice if they're conscious and alert and oriented to let them know that this is an expired drug, and we'll let them make the decision of whether we administer it or not.
But what's it like to feel like you're there breaking the law in order to save the lives?
Absolutely. And that was a real concern for our paramedics. And in fact, I really am blessed that I have an excellent legal team with the city, and our risk manager and our insurance company have all stood up and say we are going to take the responsibility, and it won't fall on the individual paramedic.
So for the most part, would you say some of the expired medicines that you've had to give out, or that you might have on board, are just maybe a little less effective as opposed to dangerous? Is that what you hear?
Yes, and that's exactly what they have found with the military and in third world countries is there was no harm caused to the patient, but it's what they call the efficacy. So in other words, you may not get as perfect or the desired result that you would like. It won't be as strong or as powerful, but you should still get some benefit from the drug. And that's what we've experienced. We haven't seen anything negative happen. We also haven't really seen much of a situation that there was much difference that we could even tell. Fortunately, the longest drug we had to give was 8 months past expiration, so I really believe that it was probably pretty close to 100% effective anyway.
Well, you got to hope the FDA is looking into solutions for your first responders so that they don't have to face this kind of shortage and hand us expired medications. Are they promising they are?
Well, there is some pending legislation, and of course, everything is amazing that it's taken 2 years now for it to get to this point. But the FDA has now finally started talking about proposing legislation that would require drug manufacturers to give advance notice that they're going to stop manufacturing a drug.
Uh-huh.
And what that will do, it will allow those of us, and it's just not us, it's hospitals and clinics are facing the same situation, allow us time to actually try to find alternative drugs, but more importantly, to train our paramedics on how to use the new drugs. And that's one of the big worries is even if you could find an alternate drug, there's a training component that has to be involved. At 2 a.m. when someone's making decisions, it's nice that they can use a drug that they're used to.
Well, but I just really appreciate you going to bat for all of us, because by you speaking out when everybody else isn't, that's making a difference for all of us all around the country. Tom Wright, thank you for joining us from Bend, Oregon Fire Department.
Time to discuss, dissect, and debate the news. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
It's about 2:20. Elisa Jaffe in this week for Ken Schramm, and we are hearing about some big breakthroughs in the world of Alzheimer's. We hope so, because more than 5 million Americans suffer with Alzheimer's. An estimated 35 million people around the world have dementia, which includes Alzheimer's. And at this point, there is no cure. And this is crippling, fatal, horrible, horrible way to go. And so we are hearing about this big conference this weekend where about 6,000 leading researchers from all around the world are coming here to the Northwest, coming to Vancouver to go to this Alzheimer's conference. And with us is Bob Leroy. He is the CEO and the president of the Alzheimer's Association here in our state in Western Washington. There's been some major news that's come out this week. Why don't you rattle off some of the different things? Because the drugs that they're talking about could be a big deal for Alzheimer's patients.
Well, I think the most exciting news this week, Elisa, is the discovery of a genetic mutation, which early evidence suggests may protect the brain from excessive beta amyloid, which has long been held to be one of the causes of Alzheimer's disease. And like a lot of our research, it's really too soon to tell what the scope and scale of this finding might be. But what it's created is some opportunities for us to talk about the importance of Alzheimer's research and also the role that the Alzheimer's Association plays in moving that research forward.
So if you find out about this, and this is the genetic form of Alzheimer's, though, right? That's just
correct.
One form, and that's it's minor compared to most of the cases?
Relatively speaking, but it's...
I mean, it's still a lot of people, but it's...
It's also important to realize how much we still have to learn about all of this, including the genetic piece.
But there was some information about new drugs that are being tested, and you might find out that kind of information or the results, will you this weekend at the big conference in Vancouver?
What we'll have an opportunity to find out this weekend is the best thinking of, as you suggest, over 6,000 of the leading researchers from all over the world who will be gathering for the annual Alzheimer's Association International Conference. And it's a great opportunity for them to come together and share their best current thinking and the results of their research.
Because that's the one thing we want to hear. We want to hear that some of these test trials have worked because we're waiting and waiting. And if they fail, you know, there's going to be so much frustration. Are people even going to go back to the drawing board? But if they work and they actually do slow the progress of Alzheimer's, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it would be huge for us. All we can really do right now is deal with the symptoms of the disease and in some cases, perhaps prolong quality of life. But there is no prevention. There is no cure for Alzheimer's at this point in time. The good news is we have over 127 drugs in various stages of clinical trials. One of the challenges, though, is populating those trials. It can often take as long as 5 months to fully populate a clinical trial.
What do you mean by populate? You mean get people to do just to do it?
Exactly. Get people to participate. And in fact, to deal with this, the Alzheimer's Association, about a year ago, launched a new interactive online program. So an individual can go online, complete a profile, talk with one of our professional consultants, and find out what clinical trials are going on that might be an appropriate match
because
for the individual.
Because I know they have them at the UW, so it's very
do.
Important here, and it's a great yeah. university. So in the minute mm-hmm. we have left, can you tell anybody how to go online and find out how to get involved in a trial, if that's what you need.
Absolutely. You can go on our chapter website, which is www.alzwa.org.
Okay, and I hope next week somebody from your organization will join us on Smart Talk Mornings on 570 KVI so we can hear the results of what happened at this big conference over the weekend in Vancouver.
We would welcome the opportunity. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Bob, thank you for being with us. Bob Leroy of the Alzheimer's Association.
This is Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
A nanny goat and a billy goat in Orange County, California are wowing beachgoers with their surfing skills. The two goats' owners says he taught his goats to surf because he loves to ride the waves and thought they'd like it too. Well, only in California. But here in Washington, how we're registering the dogs and the dead to vote.
Como News Radio, everything you need to know. Now, Newsline with Ken Schramm.
Elisa Jaffe in for Ken Schramm. It's 2:35. Great article in the paper today about these voter registration forms that have been showing up in the mail. And one showed up for Rosie Charleston. And all the info was right. It was in there encouraging, you know, Rosie to get out and vote. Big problem was Rosie She lives in Seattle. Well, first problem, Rosie is dead. Died back in 1998. Second problem is, Rosie's a dog. A black lab. And we've got with us Shane Hamlin, the co-director for the Secretary of State's Election Division. And Shane, a lot of people are complaining because it seems like this group called the Voter Participation Center has been distributing a lot of registration forms in recent weeks that are sometimes targeting people who are not alive anymore and people who are not even people, some who are animals, correct?
Yes, people have been contacting our office who've received these mailings. Either they're confused. Most often they're confused because they actually are already registered.
Oh, so they're already registered and now they're being asked to register?
Right. So the Voter Participation Center is a national group that is mailing somewhat complete or almost complete voter registration forms into almost every state. And they're doing this in an effort to get people registered to vote, to participate in the election, which is not a bad goal. Obviously, we support voter registration, but the way they're doing it is creating a lot of confusion and frustration. I think in many states and in ours as well, you started with the example of Rosie. And during the first part of June, our office took literally hundreds of calls and emails from people who received this mailing to either complain that they were, you know, that they had received a form that was pre-filled for either a deceased relative, one or two cases of a pet, or a minor child in the household, or they were registered, believed they were registered and everything was up to date, and now they were confused because they got a mailing that said that the information may be out of date or that they need to register.
Yeah, because I go on to read more in this article. There's a Virginia man who said he got the same kind of documents as Rosie the dog in Seattle did, and this one arrived for his dead dog, Mozart, while another woman got a form for her cat, Scampers. So a lot of different pets, and they're all filled out. So who is behind this? What is this group, the Voter Participation Center?
Well, the Voter Participation Center... and I believe the article you're referring to actually includes quotes from their president. They're using commercially available data, so commercial mailing lists like magazine subscriptions and other commercial data, as well as they say they're using publicly available voter registration data.
Well, then
to create
who's registered
lists.
Their dog, though?
Well, so if you get a subscription to a magazine in your pet's name, then your pet's name and your address is going to end up on a commercial mailing list.
Uh-huh.
And so if they pull from that commercial mailing list and your pet is on there and they use it, then a voter registration form from the Voter Participation Center could show up. I mean, that is our best guess as to how pets are getting these voter registration forms.
I just don't know anybody who's got magazines for their
pets. Someone who called us did in fact admit that they had a subscription to a pet magazine in their pet's name.
Oh, okay. So that's where you get that, because I'm like, who does that? It's hard to even believe. But so Shane Hamlin, this has got to be an issue for a lot of people because it's, imagine the emotions that surface when you do get a registration form that's almost all filled out for a relative who you've lost.
Yes, and that's what our staff, we actually had to hire additional temporary staff to help us manage the phone calls and emails that we were getting, and most of the callers were very emotional. They were either upset because, they received a form on behalf of a deceased family member, which is one set of emotions, or they thought they were properly registered, in which case they were usually just frustrated and confused and felt like someone might be trying to trick them or perpetrate some type of fraud. Or they were admitting that they've received a form in a pet's name or in a child's name in the household. And they were also all upset, but for different reasons. And, of course, that concerns us because we want voters to have confidence in the voter registration mm-hmm. system. We want voters to know that their information is up to date or know how to properly update their information so that they can get a ballot and participate. And so we've been kind of managing the outcome of these mailings in our office and at the counties have as well. And we've been in regular communication with the Voter Participation Center, sending direct communication to their spokesperson, the office that's handling their affairs for the states, and making them aware of the impact on our office and in other states. They are aware of how it's impacting us, but what they really care about is getting people registered And they're not too apologetic about the impact it's having on our
office
or the confusion it could be causing. No, not really. I mean, they're not flippant about it, but their goal is to get people registered, and they're getting data that shows one out of three or one out of four mailings that they do actually results in a registration. So, you know, the three or four that were, or the two or three that were bad out of that four, well, that's just the price of doing outreach like this.
Shane Hamlin is with the Secretary of State's Elections Division. So they're not doing anything illegal.
No, they're not. We have asked them to use, one thing they could do to reduce the inaccurate mailings they're doing is they could do a better job of looking at our list of people who are already registered. People who are registered should not be getting these mailings, and if they bought the CD from us for $7, a copy of the state voter rolls, and actually ran that against their mailing list before they sent it out, they could reduce the number, they could reduce confusion and reduce the number of mailings they're sending into states.
So it makes sense that people are concerned about fraud when they get something like this in the mail. Are there any cases of fraud regarding voter registration these days?
Well, in terms of the Voter Participation Center, obviously they're on record as saying they're relying on the local and state election administrators to catch any fraudulent voter registrations that might be a result of their mailing. And I appreciate the confidence and faith they have in us because we do have good checks in place. But for voters, the person, again, who receives a form in their pet's name or a deceased family member's name, they've lost confidence in the system until they understand how it is that they came to get that form, which we spent a lot of time on the phone talking to them about or in an email writing back to them. And we haven't seen any fraud from these mailings other than these mailings that go to ineligible children.
Sure.
Or deceased or pets. And so when the counties process them, they're going to go through their normal procedures. But there is some risk, and the risk in the sense that they're not doing a very good job of screening their data.
And it just opens the floodgates for criticism, too, because this is a left-leaning organization, and they admit that they're, you know, working on this. And then you've got in the GOP political leader saying, wait a second, this means, you know, you're pushing it. You're with your registration drives. They're rather sloppy. And now I'm wondering, when do we know if it is a case of fraud? Maybe this isn't fraud because they're allowed to do this, and it might just be sloppy. But how do we know when we get something in the mail if it's legit?
Well, and that's why what we have been telling callers, either through email or phone, is that if they are not eligible to vote, if they know they are not, if they're not a citizen, if they perhaps are not eligible for one of the other reasons, don't complete the form and don't mail it in. Throw it away. And we've looked at those who think they are registered. We can look them up while they're on the phone with us, and we can tell them before the conversation's over, you're properly registered. Here, is this your current address? Okay, you can throw the form away. Don't complete it.
And don't let your dog go to the polls. Right.
Yeah. Don't mail in a ballot on behalf of your dog.
Yeah, appreciate it, Shane Hamlin, with the Secretary of State's Elections Division. I can't believe it. A black lab, a cat, all these people being all these pets being registered to vote. They can't be that hard up for the votes, can they?
Seattle's waking up to the Como Morning News 5 to 9 right now. Newsline PM with Ken Schramm on Como News Radio.
Alisa Jaffe in for Ken Schramm. Our members of Seattle's legendary Almost Live cast preparing to resurrect that comedy show. Well, if you check things out on YouTube and there's this new video, it makes you wonder if Pat Cashman and John Keister and Steve Wilson and Nancy Guppy and Bill Nye and who else do we have? Joel McHale, Bill Stanton, you name it, Tracy Conway, so many amazing people. Are they going to be coming back? Are they going to be doing something called the 206?
Here's a little preview.
To the camera, you idiot!
Of a new show intent on bringing comedy back to local TV.
Well, all I know is I've been watching Almost Live for I don't know how many years because it's still on the air, but they're the old episodes. They do the reruns, and so you know the comedy sketches could come back, maybe under a new name. Pat Cashman, clear up the rumors for us. We'd love to have you back on the air here. What do you think?
I will answer all those questions you have posed tonight at 11.
No, you won't. Answer them now. Help me out.
That's right. There's the 10 o'clock news. I'll do it then. That's
okay.
What I'll do.
Or the 6, or the 5, or the 4.
Thanks for having me on. I thought I was going to come on with Ken Schramm.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I don't think that, and I'm not disappointed that you're
Ken
Schramm, but I think Ken Schramm might have been the punchline to more jokes on Almost Live than any single person in the Northwest.
I think he was up there, wasn't he? Along with my old co-host on Northwest Afternoon, Cindy Reinhart. You had some fun with her as well, I remember.
Yeah. Certainly her. I don't remember all the Ken Schramm jokes, but I remember there was one about a new children's book coming out called Green Eggs and Schramm. And I hope that wasn't the best joke.
No. And I know I just watched it when I was at the Emmy Awards recently, and your son was there, and he pulled out one of my favorite old Almost Live skits, Sluggy. And that was that your child Chris's debut with Sluggy?
He actually debuted a little when he was still in diapers on another station in another market. But, yeah, that was his first, dramatic role.
Yeah, with his pet Slug. So what are you guys thinking? Are you and Keister talking about really bringing back Almost Live?
No, I don't think it would be correct to say that.
Because then you're going to call it something else?
We're calling it The 206, actually. We had thought about either calling it The 206 or calling it Not The 509. But we went with The 206 instead.
And what are you doing?
It is sketch comedy, and so I guess you could say from some of the creators of Almost Live comes this new thing, The 206. We were approached by the producers of Bill Nye the Science Guy show. You remember Disney's series that ran for years and years? They are local. That Bill Nye show was produced locally, of course, and they approached us to about this idea of trying to resurrect some kind of comedy show, sketch show, in this market. I did the math on it, and Almost Live ran for 15 seasons, and that ended in 1999, the production, but they've continued to rerun it on both King TV and in Kong TV for 13 years up to the present. So that's a total of 28 years in that show, which I think may break all records for local.
Have you gotten paid for any of the past 13 years of reruns?
Oh, yeah. The money's rolling in.
Yeah, is it now?
yeah. In fact, we're making more money now than we ever did producing the show.
I'll bet. You know, I know you say it's about comedy sketches and maybe sketchy comedy, but let's listen to a little bit from maybe the 206. Let's listen.
At the site of the tunnel that is going to be replacing the Alaskan Way Viaduct, we understand that there is some construction delay.
No, that is incorrect. We are ahead of schedule. The seawall is holding up just fine. No seepage, no sewer line fails, no ancient curses.
Did you say ancient curse?
Isn't that an intriguing idea?
I think it is.
What if there is an ancient curse to be discovered in this tunnel project? It's going to make it a lot more interesting.
I think it will. Hey, did Portlandia have anything to do with this? Because that's been so successful and local and fun.
I guess in a way you could. It didn't have anything to do with our new effort, but I mean the sensibility of the uniqueness and the quirkiness of the neighborhoods and cities of the Northwest. Mm-hmm. We certainly share that relationship.
When can we expect this, Pat?
Well, we don't know. We're working on it. We would love it to be on next week. We're in the middle of negotiations with a number of entities around here. Mm-hmm. And beyond it being just a TV sketch show, which is fine, it's also going to, of course, have a web presence and social media will be involved. And we're also going to take it into live events as well. So
that'd be great. How much of the original cast?
We don't know yet. Some of the cast, like I've talked to Joel McHale and I told him to dump
his big
NBC
gig
show and come and work on this. He said he's thinking about it.
Uh-huh.
But we'll see. Initially, John Keister and myself and my son Chris, whom you mentioned, are part of it, and we'll see if other people can be persuaded to leave their otherwise lucrative jobs to to come and join us, or at least occasionally.
Hey,
as I mentioned yesterday, we are operating on kind of the arena model. We want a billionaire to basically pay for the show, and then we'll have the public pick up the rest.
I'll give Chris a call for you. Hey, thank you. And this is for you. That's my high five and white girl for you, Pat Cashman.
That's right.
Thanks a lot for being with us on Newsline PM.